What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. This week, our special guest is Dr. Kenneth Padel. We are also visited by Kathy Shupa and Sean Reedy. I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson, and we are talking about concussions. Is there anything new? So are we talking about what's new in managing and treating and just dealing with concussions? Because we're always overwhelmed with concussions, so we're going to find out what's new and what Houston Methodist is doing in leading medicine in dealing with concussions. If you want to join the conversation, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com. This one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/PODELL, so Padel. This one is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/PODELL, Padel. Without much further ado, Dr. Kenneth Padel, welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right, I want to start off with what's new in diagnosing concussions. I'm part of a sports medicine group, Sports Medicine University, and they put out some articles, or I've seen some articles on there about like hearing tests or blood tests for diagnosing concussions. Can you talk about what's new in diagnosing concussions?
Sure. There's a lot of different things that we can kind of talk about. And I guess one of the best places to start is on the sideline, where if we're thinking about sports concussions, probably the most critical part is being able to diagnose it during the competition. So if we talk about sideline assessments, we have a couple of new things that are coming out and a couple of different ways that we're doing it. And we have a couple of good tools out there. Probably the most common used tool is the sideline concussion assessment tool, which is also called the SCAT. It's pretty much the standard in diagnosing concussions. But a couple of other newer things, and that's Let me talk about the SCAT for a second. That looks at symptoms. It looks at memory, concentration. It looks at balance, some neurological signs, orientation. So it kind of tries to get a pretty good complement, a full range of behaviors or changes that we can see in concussions. But what we notice with the SCAT sometimes is we can miss concussions every once in a while. And people can do well on the SCAT and still technically be concussed. So a couple of different new developments. One of them is something called a King-Devick test. And what we are really becoming interested in diagnosing concussions is simply eye movements. About half of your brain's involved in controlling your eyes. So it would make sense that if there is a concussion and the brain's affected, it might affect your vision. So there are different eye tracking tasks that can be used. Some of them are very simple, where all you're doing is reading numbers across the line, and you have to do it by speed, so it affects eye tracking that way. Others, there are some sophisticated tests out there that put goggles over the eyes, and that's where what we're literally doing is measuring eye movements with very minute computers, and there's some virtual reality stuff going on out there where they'll put on the goggles and they have to go through different scenarios and memory testing. And we also have tablets, so like an iPad or a Surface, where they have to do certain memory or concentration or reaction time tests. So there's a lot of different developments going on in helping us to diagnose the acute concussion, whether it be in the sideline, whether it be in the emergency room. We just finished, we were part of a multi-site study. We just finished a two-year study looking at a portable EEG system that runs off of a cell phone. It runs off of your Android phone. Little plastic electrodes, seven of them that hook up across the front of your head. And we've been involved in helping develop the EEG patterns, what we call logarithms, to diagnose concussions acutely. It will have applications for the military. So for our soldiers to kind of help them with the diagnosis of concussion during blasts or any other types of injuries. So as you can see, there's a lot of different ways, different areas where we're trying to improve diagnosing concussions. One of the other things that we can kind of talk a little bit about that we're also developing here at Houston Methodist is telemedicine, where just like I'm doing right now, we're using Skype or we're using a secured connection, and I'm doing my concussion evaluations remotely in different areas or parts of Texas where they may not have the expert care that we're doing. That is a grant that was funded by the Houston Texans and General Electric. We're gracious enough to kind of support this two-year pilot study. So we're working out with East Texas and some of the schools, about 29 different school districts out there where we're doing some of this. And there's no reason something like this can't be brought onto the sidelines. or even in an ambulance where there could be some telemedicine or evaluations done remotely as well. So on the sidelines, we have a lot going on to help us kind of diagnose concussions. And if we look over in the clinic as well, we have a lot of new developments going on there. I know that Jeremy discussed a little bit about blood tests and biomarkers, and that's a big, big area where we're trying to understand acute changes in the chemistry or the physiology, and we measure that. It can be with like blood tests. The problem with that is you have to draw the blood and then you have to get it over to the lab and analyze it in the lab. So we don't have this kind of quick blood test where you can stick a little something in it and changes a color or a positive sign yet. But we do see breakdown of certain proteins in the bloodstream or the cerebrospinal fluid of concussed athletes. So there's a big direction of looking for that kind of blood test marker, and hopefully it can be developed to the point that you could do a little finger prick maybe on the sideline and kind of get a real quick read right then and there. Problem with that is sometimes the biomarkers develop over time. They may not happen right at the moment of impact. They could happen minutes or hours down the road. So again, we're always going to be in this elusive state of there may not be that magic thing that we're looking for, that as soon as you're hit, it's going to detect whether it's a concussion, because we do know that sometimes the concussions will develop well over time, so within hours. So with the biomarkers, there's a lot of promise. Different ways of new techniques for brain MRI are trying to be developed. GE and the NFL have a study that we're a part of that we're looking at different ways of tweaking MRIs to look for concussions as well. So there's a lot of kind of exciting different fronts going on. When I'm in the clinic, one of the things that we're really interested in is not so much the diagnosis of concussion, but we're often interested in when are they better? When are they going to get over the concussions? So there's a lot of different tools and techniques that we'll use there. Balance and eye movements are becoming more commonly used in the clinic. And what we're finding at that there's a small percentage, maybe 20% or so, that have some residual eye motor movement problems. And they can be significant source of headache, dizziness, mental fogginess, concentration problems, fatigue. And what we see sometimes that the brain might be doing okay, but their balance and their eye movements are off. And with good physical therapy, with physical therapists who know how to treat those types of disorders, we can often get them back to feeling pretty normal. So we got a lot of different things going on in terms of looking at clinic things, of balance. Eye movements are probably the two biggest things that we're seeing in our clinic to kind of that for long-term recovery and kind of going after those a little bit more. We'd like to see this kind of disseminated out a little bit more to some of the primary care doctors, the pediatricians, so they have a little bit better sense of what's going on in those areas. So there's some of the newer things in the diagnosis of concussions that I think we're going to start to see a little bit more of.
One of the questions that I wanted to have is the King-Devick test, right? So you said y'all were creating part of the pilot study for the cell phone and the ECG. Do you have any more information about that?
About which study? I'm sorry.
The pilot study with the ECG. Was it the ECG and the cell phone? That's not the King David. That was the ECG.
Oh, yeah, the EEG.
I'm sorry,
yeah.
EEG and cell phone.
So that is, there's a company called BrainScope that owns the equipment. It's FDA approved, and they've been at it for about 15 years, I believe, 10, 15 years. They've been approved to be used in emergency rooms as well. So if you can look up a company called BrainScope, they are starting to commercialize the product so it can be bought and used in different clinics. And we're kind of talking to BrainScope now maybe to see if that's something that we can help pilot in our clinic as well.
Now, is that something that you expect or see being in athletic training rooms, let's say in our athletic training room that you have, that you can use or we use, or I guess how is that device used?
So the device is going to be used primarily on the sideline, or if you bring them back to your training area, it will be used in the training area. And I do suspect that in the next couple of years, the way we assess concussions on the sideline is going to drastically change. It's no more what are your symptoms necessarily, or how many fingers am I holding up, or how many words can you recall. I think there's a big push to be more objective, so more biologically based. EEG would be considered a biomarker. Blood tests, saliva tests. I think we're a ways out for some of that, but something like this EEG application is now FDA approved. It's been used in stroke for a while. So I think there's some potential that in the next several years, we're going to see a big change in how we diagnose concussions on the sideline.
Until we get to the point where we're able to use the latest technology, using SCAT on the sidelines. I'm particularly now working with intermediate, you know, I have 12-year-old to 14-year-olds. What would be your recommendation for the sideline evaluation other than SCAT? Sometimes they don't even understand the questions when we're going through the symptoms. You know, you have to, you know, break it down to understand the symptoms in a more easier language or using analogies. Information I could use for the intermediates?
Sure. There is a child SCAT now. So they did kind of change it around. And it focuses exactly what you're talking about, Kathy. What they're trying to do is make the scale appropriate for the age. And the symptom descriptions are different. So it's not like, do you have a headache? Does your head hurt, for example? Do you feel wobbly? No, not necessarily. Do you feel dizzy? Okay. So they're really tweaking the words and bring, you know, like what's, you know, drowsiness. I get asked a lot with my younger students, what does drowsiness mean? Okay. Irritability. So they are changing the words around a little bit. And what they also do with the little kids is they use pictures now. Okay, so not necessarily a word, is they use a picture to help them describe. So you draw the face and do you feel this way? Do you feel that way? You know, the kids can repeat numbers. They can repeat some basic words like apple, ball, you know, stick, things like that. So we can bring it down a little bit, but you make a very good point. You know, how young of an age can we do this at? Can we do that reliably with a six-year-old? And the answer is sometimes not. So what we'll do in a situation like that is you do a little bit of an observation, okay? Are they slower? Can they, you know, are they having a harder time focusing? Are they squinting more? We're going to treat it more of an observational type of thing. And I think what we tend to do with our younger athletes is when in doubt, we're really going to not guess at all, and we're really going to hold them out. And I suspect with our younger kids, we're more likely holding them out, over-diagnosing concussion, so to speak. But that's okay, because it's rather safe than sorry. And as they get older, we can maybe fine-tune it a little bit more.
You brought up something like the King Devic. And just going back on some of those things of what's something else. I know we've talked about at certain times or you know, it's kind of brought to our attention about some of these different balance-type testing. So using a cell phone, using an iPad, using a tablet of some sort, what's going on with that? What's the things that you've seen? What should we steer clear of, or maybe think, hey, this might be something that is in the future, or is that in the future?
Mm-hmm. Sure. In terms of balance assessment, what a lot of people have tried to do, so the balance assessment stuff started with the balance error scoring system, Kevin Guskowitz down at University of North Carolina, and it was a great start. And what he was able to do with certain positions, whether it's standing with your feet together, standing on one leg, or tandem, one leg in front of the other, straight line. The problem with something like just observing someone is, how do you quantify the errors? And so there, other people came up and they've started to use tablets and cell phones because they have gyroscopes in them, and their you know, your iPhone or your Android phone is a very good medical device. You can measure heart rate, you can measure EEG, you can measure blood pressure, all of those things. So what they've done, as you make a very good point, is that what they try to do is use that to measure balance objectively, so you can come up with a number and perhaps compare it to a baseline. And I think that's what they're trying to do with being a little bit more accurate with that. The problem with something like balance is it's like a lot of things with the concussions. There's no one thing that says it's a concussion. So a lot of times balance can be intact and they still have that concussion. Okay. A lot of times what we can see with some players is that their balance can be off because of lower extremity changes. Okay. And, our linemen, you know, three quarters of the way into the season, their knees and their ankles may not be as stable as it was in baseline. And so then, so there's a lot of complicating factors that, that kind of go into it. But it's, again, the more tools we have in our toolbox, the better we get at doing this thing of diagnosing concussion.
We talked a lot about the diagnosing. Let's go to the post-injury. You know, we've all been well versed here in the state of Texas for at least the scholastic return to play, but you have that those athletes that they are they have symptoms and they're, you know, one or two on the headache and, you know, one or two on maybe light sensitivity. And we have implemented through you, Dr. Padel, this Buffalo treadmill test where we can get this kid athlete doing some exertion, you know, under the guidance of the athletic trainer through the physician. Could you elaborate on that? Because it's really a very cost-effective way to progress that kid into return to play.
Yeah. So what you're discussing, Kathy, is the Buffalo treadmill test, and it was developed by Dr. John Leddy out at Buffalo. Okay, obviously. And what he does is very, very great thinking on his part is he leverages one of the problems that we know happens in concussions. After your brain is concussed, you do have a harder time controlling heart rate. So there are parts of the brain that control heart rate and breathing and involved in that. And we do know that that's off a little bit. So and some concussed athletes, they have they could have exercise intolerance because of that poor control over the beating of the heart, which affects your breathing, which affects the amount of carbon dioxide in your bloodstream and all of those things. So what he's done is taken this a treadmill test protocol that was used for cardiac patients and adopted it for concussed athletes. So it can be, number one, used for diagnosis. Number two, it can be used to bring them back to slowly progress athletes. So real quick, you put them on a treadmill, you're hooking up heart rate, blood pressure, you're monitoring their symptoms. You start off at a certain speed for a certain period of time. You assess this symptoms and then you and heart rate and blood pressure, and you slowly progress the intensity of that exercise, and then you can monitor all of the physiological aspects of exercise as well as their symptoms, and you can see where they start to become symptomatic. You can hold them there for a little while until they feel better and slowly progress them up. So it's a little bit more scientific or objective way of managing them instead of just saying go out and run light cardio. What does that mean? And Dr. Braunreiter at Sugarland, Dr. David Braunreiter at Sugarland, has really been pioneering that for Houston Methodist.
What are some other things post concussion? So that I know that you talked about having post concussive patients having them see PT and things like that. What are some things? I know I've spoken to some people such as at the Air Force Academy. Thinking of Air Force Academy, obviously they need to utilize, or they need later in their career, once they go on, they potentially are going to have very good vision, things like that, and be very focused in on rehabbing that for later on in their career. They can't have issues that have been caused by concussion or been caused by something. They're doing some different types of vision training, sometimes with all of their athletes. And I know that there's some in sports of baseball where hand-eye coordination is big, that they do that as well. But what are some things out there that you know of, or are there some things that for the athletic trainers that we can do to help them? Like once they've come down off of, all right, they're not symptomatic or they're not having these issues and they're out of that, all right, we're returning them to play, but these are other things that we can do with them. Are there things like that that you know of?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. And, you know, one of the things that you always have to remember is if you have an athlete that's concussed, and let's say they're taken out of their sport for 10 days, just hypothetically speaking, in 10 days, a lot of things are not going to be as sharp or as in shape as they were prior to the injury. And that only goes for strength, it goes for cardiovascular, but it also probably goes for hand-eye coordination and a lot of different things. So you can see some deconditioning across that. And there are some visual scanning equipment out there that D2, it's called, is one of the things where it's a big black electronic board with a large circle with bunch of dots, red lights on them, and they can flash intermittently, and the athlete has to stand in front, focus in the center, and then learn to go with improving peripheral vision and reaction time. There are some programs that actually train these athletes pre-season or during season to keep that sharp with some intent of reducing concussions, probably by avoiding a hit or being able to see something coming out of their side and not get a blindside hit. So any kind of hand-eye coordination training will help those individuals if there was a concussion and if they had some trouble with ocular motor skills. There's a lot of tracking that we'll do with the athletes. Sometimes what we'll do with athletes is we'll have them walk down a long hallway and they have to hold out sticks with arms length out and they have to read numbers turning their head while they walk, and we'll increase the pace. We'll make them go through a little bit of an obstacle course, so they have to kind of constantly move their eyes back and forth between reading and looking. So anything that's going to tax the system or get it to do things a little bit differently are going to go a long way in bringing back the visual motor and the ocular motor skills. If you bring up pilots, pilots have a whole special set of skills that they need that is just not typical of the average person. And I'm sure there's a lot of more sophisticated stuff with spatial skills that pilots have to go through.
Some of the things that I know I've talked to them about, they're pretty cool and it's pretty easy. Like, they use a thing called a Brock string, and we'll sit there and work on focus, and some of the stuff is very interesting. So
that's a great topic we'll have to get. So one of the things, what is, I know you said there's no one test for concussions, but if you're standing on the sideline, Dr. Padel, what is kind of the thing you're going to go best for? Because you said the balance error scoring system is very subjective and you're wanting to move towards objective. If you're on the sidelines, what are you going to do?
So one of the most important things I always kind of say, and it sounds a little corny, but you have to know your athlete. And that's really, really important. And athletic trainers know their athletes very well. And that's the first thing you're going to do. You're going to pull them off or her off of the field, and you're going to just start talking to them. And you just want to see how crisp, how clear are their answers to you? Are they able to look you in the eye and hold this normal conversation? Do you have a lot of delays, a lot of ums, a lot of ahs? Are they not able to answer your questions very clearly? I mean, that's the first thing that you're going to start going for. And then when you start a formal assessment, eye tracking, smooth pursuits are a very common thing to do, to look at that. There are some ocular motor assessments that we can do where instead of just having them track your finger, what you do is you hold an object in front of them and they have to shake their head like this, keeping their eye on that object. It taxes the ocular motor system in a dynamic fashion rather than a passive fashion where they're just following your finger. And therefore, more active assessment, it's harder to do. And if they start to get dizzy, if they start to squint, if they can't keep moving their head, they're all signs that they might be signs of a concussion. So you can do it that way. You're going to ask them their symptoms. You know, do you have this? Do you have a headache? Are you sensitive to light? Are they squinting more? Are they looking away? Can they hold their balance? And then strength is very important. We're looking for upper extremity strength, weakness, any numbness, any tingling. We're really making sure that there's no significant cervical or any spine-related injuries. We can assess their memory by repeating digits backwards, forwards, by having them remember a list of 4 or 5 words and then asking them to repeat it 5 minutes later. You can exert them. You can have them do a little bit of running to see if that makes their symptoms a little bit worse. Or there are some of the more common ways that we're going to do it. If you wanted to use King Devic on the sideline, it's a little pamphlet, have it in your pocket, take it out. There was a baseline score that you would have for that athlete, and they have to go through the King Devic. If they slow down on that, that might be a sign of concussion, and we're probably at that point going to hold them out.
What about the scat on the scat three on the sideline? Because I know we've kind of talked about it, and you a lot of times prefer to get them away from the sideline, go do your scat inside. Sometimes, especially in certain instances, what for the high school athletic trainer, is that something that you can utilize as well? Or would that be more of once you've gotten into the athletic training room? Because I know athletic trainers that use it in both settings, kind of on the sideline as well as then, all right, after I've already pulled them.
Right. So one of the advantages of getting them off of the field into the training area is it gives you an opportunity to have a nice little conversation with them on the way up. And it also buys a little time. So let's say it takes 3-4 minutes. If there is a concussion over 3-4 minutes, the symptoms might be getting a little bit worse and you're more likely to discover it at that point in time. And sometimes they have to walk up steps to get to the training area in certain venues, and you can look at their balance and you can look at a little bit of an exertion of going up a flight of stairs. I remember when I used to do this with the Detroit Lions, it was about 3 flights of stairs, really steep, that the athlete had to walk up in cleats, no less, when we used to assess them on the sideline. And if these athletes were holding on to the handrails to make it up those steps, that kind of made me question a little bit of their balance being off. So my preference is to pull them off, but I know from a practical standpoint, as well as you do, that that's not always going to happen. And sometimes you're going to be doing it right there on the sideline, right, you know, behind the bench or something like that. So I prefer a little bit quiet, controlled area, and I use that time to get there to kind of be part of my assessment, but we can do it on the sideline as well.
Ideally, you know, we'd like to remove them, but if you're the only athletic trainer and you're responsible for gameplay as well, you know, you couldn't do that. Have you seen any studies that would show you if you were able to perform the scat or the other test right away, or if it happened, you know, at halftime or happened after the game, is that going to skew the results at all?
You mean if it takes a little bit longer to,
yes, sir,
to do the assessment?
Yes.
It's not necessarily going to skew the results, because if they're concussed, they should still have some of the symptoms and some of the problems 5-10 minutes later. You know, where you do run into a problem is if you're going to pull them and you're diagnosing a concussion and you're not assessing them, you know, kind of the standard of care, somebody needs to keep an eye on them because you want to make sure that there's no significant neurological emergency. So whether that's going to be a teammate, a coach, or somebody else, it's always preferable to kind of manage that or come back to them 10, 15 minutes later.
Right. I'm sorry, I didn't state the question right, is just do a basic assessment of the athlete and get, you know, get some data on the athlete and then do a full assessment maybe at halftime, you know, when your eyes aren't on the field. So
absolutely. I'm sorry if I misunderstood.
No, that's
it.
Okay.
Yeah. If you do enough of an evaluation and you're confident with your experience that they're concussed, they're done, they're out, you pull them and then you come back a little bit later and do a full assessment. Absolutely not a problem at all. You know, the whole idea of the sideline assessment is to make sure that they don't return playing concussed. And that, because that's when we get into problems. We know at the very least it takes them twice as long to recover from the concussion if they continue to play. And worst case scenario is you can land up with a neurological emergency.
I have a question that has related to when an athlete is doing their return to play. What is your feeling on tracking the symptoms? Do you have the athletic trainer check the symptoms every day? Do you have them check it every other day? How do you do that? And do you prefer they do it before they begin the stage, after the stage? What are your thoughts on that?
You know, the short answer is it does vary sometimes, but I don't necessarily measure concussion symptoms every single day if they're significantly concussed. So if we know we're not returning them, so the post-concussion symptom scale that we all use, let's say they have a 30 on a Sunday, the day after a college game, okay? I probably may not assess their symptoms again until Tuesday, because there's no way that Monday they're going to be ready for a return to play. The problem with assessing the symptoms every single day is it sensitizes them to the symptoms. okay? And I'd rather give them a little bit of breathing room and not sensitize. Whenever we rate ourselves on the same thing every single day, it becomes a little bit different. It becomes more of a relative than an absolute rating, and I'd rather have an absolute rating. So I kind of like wait a day. If we're getting closer and we start a return to play, I like to measure their symptoms after they finish that stage of the return to play, or even if it's an exercise, because what we're doing now is there's plenty of times, and one of the biggest changes that we're seeing in concussion and return to play and recovery is we start exercising much sooner. No more wait until you're asymptomatic. Okay, that we know that that does not work anymore. After about 72 hours, depending on the symptom severity, we might start light exercise, walking for 5 minutes, walking for 10 minutes. And if I know on their symptom scale, let's say they have a low score of 8 or 10 symptoms, we're not ready for return to play, but we're definitely ready for exercising. And what we're showing after 4 or 5 days, mild light exercising helps with concussion recovery, and resting actually hurts recovery. Okay. And it's the exact opposite of what we used to practice. So we're all a little bit guilty of that. But the research is coming pretty clear that we need to change that. So I will measure their symptoms after each stage of any type of exercise, whether it's treatment or return to play.
Okay. But they still will be totally asymptomatic before you begin the stages, correct?
They need to be asymptomatic before we start getting them into the higher levels of a return to play. Okay. So stage one, if they have 3, 4, or 5, or they have a low score, I don't have any problems with 15 minutes of cardio at 50% of maximum heart rate. That's fine. But when we get into the more intense of 30 to 40 minute and you're at 70% or, is 80%, then I really want them to be very, very low. Absolutely, they're not going back if they have any residual symptoms from the concussion, or they're not going back to practice either.
Right. Thank you.
With regard to that, reporting your symptoms, there are some new reporting ways, correct, as well, with regard to some apps and things, kind of like that telemedicine that you had talked about?
Yeah, the symptom question, bottom line, symptom reporting is subjective, just like pain. It's the same concept. You just really don't know how much it is, and it's up to the individual. One of the things that I like to do out of my clinic is there is an app that we can measure those symptoms. There's a couple of different apps that will measure those symptoms, record those symptom scores, and they actually end up emailing them to me. So I don't have to, I can keep track of my patients over, let's say I see a patient on a Monday and say, I'm not sure when I need to see you back. Every other day, complete the app, submit it to me, and then I'll monitor their symptoms. And it could be that in 2, 3 days, their symptoms improve. And I'll say, I'll see you on Friday because their symptoms improved. Or come Friday, I don't want to see you on Monday because your symptoms are still high, but this is what we're going to do. And it allows me to communicate with the parent or with the athlete about any recommendations I have. So it allows me to track it. What I used to do is have them fill out a piece of paper, make a PDF of it at home, and attach it to an email. Apps come in a lot handier for me, and I really like it.
What is that app?
There's a couple. There's one through Impact, and there's one that I think it's called Peace Post-Concussion Symptoms. And by a company called PAR, P-A-R, Psychological Assessment Resources. Most of these are free apps, or they're like 99 cents. They're really not too expensive.
If there were one or two things that you could express to the athletic trainers that would be listening when they're either doing the sideline assessment or post-concussion return to play, what would they be? Words of wisdom or how you'd want things handled?
For the athletic trainer?
Yes, sir.
The kind of words of wisdoms are that when you think about concussions, people make concussions synonymous with brain injury. And what I've been learning over the years is that these types of sports-related concussions that the athletic trainer is most commonly going to see, it's much more than just brain. And shoulders up, okay? It's your neck. All right, it's cervical, it's your vestibular, okay, system. It's your ocular motor system. It's your brain and sometimes peripheral nerves around here. I had one athlete that had chronic headaches, and she damaged a nerve that sits right here. She's a lacrosse player, a female lacrosse player. She got hit right on the mask, and she had a little peripheral nerve damage there. So sometimes you have to, if you have these patients that aren't getting better the way they should, we have to start thinking outside the box. Residual chronic headaches, you have to think about neck, okay? And it's just not headaches back here. Headaches at the top of the head can emanate from cervical, from a C1 or C2 phenomenon, okay? So that does happen. Pain behind the eyes is oftentimes trigeminal based. So there's a lot of different things of balance in ocular motor deficits can be residual deficits. For the athletic, so there's a lot of, you got to think outside the box sometimes. It may not always be the brain. It might be other things. And then there are good physical therapies that can help these patients in all of these areas. Okay. The other thing of words of wisdom is return to school. Okay. Athletic trainers are often intimately involved in helping athletes bridge that and getting back. And then there are times on a small percentage of patients where that's the last thing to get better, where they're just struggling with getting back to school. And my rule of thumb is that an athlete can't go back to competition until I know that school's going fine, because that's telling me that their brain's doing better. Okay. So there are the things that I'm really asking the athletic trainers to kind of work on a little bit and focusing on. And the other thing that's kind of sometimes the elephant in the room is the emotional reaction that these athletes can have. They're not starting, they're not playing, they're afraid of losing their spot. Maybe college sometimes afraid of losing their scholarship. And they want to do everything they can to get back. And it's making sure that they stay safe and healthy.
No.
I that's great advice.
I know one of the things that obviously we've utilized, or at Rice they utilized, is the with the neck. I know you've talked about a lot of symptoms coming from the neck is the dry needling, and I know you've talked to us about it. We've talked to you about it, and different. I know there's a lot of people out there that are utilizing that. That's been a great help, I believe, for some of those neck spasms and those neck issues that do pop up.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I'm always emphasizing neck strengthening with my athletes, particularly my female athletes. Women have a relatively larger head to neck size and neck strength. So they tend to have a little bit more movement on going on the heads. Okay. So I definitely strengthen that. And there's actually some good research coming out of some of the muscles that smaller, minor muscles in the back of the neck that actually attach to the dura lining of the brain. So if those muscles are tight and spasming, that's going to pull on the dura mater. If it pulls on the dura mater, it irritates the nerves around the brain, and bingo, you get these chronic deep headaches. So yeah, you and I are on the same page on that one.
The importance of academic accommodations, if the athlete or the parent's chosen to go to the primary care physician, how can we stress the importance of this when the medical notes come back and getting the primary care physician to help the child in the classroom, because we know the cognitive part of the healing is just as important as the physical?
That's all about education and outreach. That's all that is. That's a grassroots effort to teach practitioners about what needs to be done. The kind of good news is that that's becoming more and more commonplace, that we are getting better academic accommodations. Yet it doesn't happen all the time, and sometimes I see kids forced back into school. I would like to see some state law passed regarding this a little bit, and not so much for punitive reasons, but for more of an awareness issue. If it becomes a state law, then people become aware of it, and then once people become aware of it, it becomes a little bit more commonplace. You know, just to give you an example, the NCAA in their concussion protocols now mandate that there's a whole section on return to learn, and identifying who's going to be involved in return to learn, what's going to happen, giving academic accommodations. It's so, you know, at some levels it's there, and I would like to see this filter down a little bit to state levels where we can introduce this kind of concepts at the high school level.
Sean, in your experience at Rice University with football and the concussions. Did you guys reach out to the professors and say, hey, this person had a concussion and can we make some modifications or postpone tests?
In college athletics, obviously, we have a little bit, it's a little easier. So we reach out to the those in charge of academics, and they reach out. And usually what we get is we get what Dr. Padel sends to us. Dr. Padel sends his assessment of this athlete. I believe that this athlete has a concussion and they should be out for this amount of time. We then go on and get that onto our athletics. Obviously, we don't have to email the professors each individually because we have that resource there that they are there for that aspect. And they usually take care of that and get that out to them. But, I mean, there's always times where we've had professors email us asking, hey, I'm just checking to make sure that this is okay, this is correct. Or is this real? Is this something that, or is this something that the athlete has come up with? So there's always those checks, but yes, that is something that's how we utilize it and that's how we do it. And in my experiences with Dr. Padel, that's what we've utilized.
And here at the high school, we normally will get that information and then send it to the counselor and to the nurse, and then they'll take care of sending it out to the teachers saying, these are the accommodations from a doctor. You need to make sure you're following them. And so, all right, Dr. Padel, I know you briefly talked about the outreach and the education of physicians. You know, recently in our secondary school's Facebook group, there was an athletic trainer that got a call from a doctor saying the athlete does not need to complete a return to play because it wasn't a real concussion. They weren't actually unconscious. So what are you doing to educate physicians? Obviously, this is something that's close to your heart, so you know a lot. But people who don't deal with concussions all the time, what are you doing to help educate them?
We do. Unfortunately, those things do happen, and it gets a little complicated in those situations. But in terms of educating other healthcare professionals, typically the onus is upon that individual to only make expert or professional advice in areas that they feel competent to practice. That's number one. So if you're not familiar with concussions, find someone who is and let them help you out. In terms of educating doctors, I do give a lot of talks throughout the year with all the levels that I talk at, from kids on up to physicians. I probably give close to 35, 40 talks a year. So I'm pretty busy doing that. So it is something that I love to do. I love to, so there are talks that I would focus that are focused more on athletic trainers, on coaches, as well as those to physicians. So, we do that. We have a little bit of educational materials on our website. Houston Methodist just created a 2-hour video that helps athletic trainers and coaches reach their every other year requirement for continuing education on concussions. So we're out there a lot, and we're doing research. We're trying to do some research to help educate some of the people in the medical field as well.
All right. On your website, you mentioned that you like to individualize the treatment, make sure that each person is receiving treatment that best fits them. Talk about some of the ways that you do that, and also some of the ways that you avoid getting into a rut.
Okay. in terms of individualizing, one of the difficulties I have with concussion care is it's very hard to predict when one's going to recover or when one is not going to recover. You can't. Sometimes you say, hey, this is a no-brainer. It's a slam dunk. Couple of days you'll be fine, and a month later they're not, or the other way around. You tell a parent, you know what, based upon this, that, the other thing, I'm predicting a little protracted recovery. We're looking at 3-4 weeks, and next thing you know, 5 days later they're fine. So it's by necessity that concussions have to be treated individually. With a lot of injuries, joint injuries, people recover differently from injuries there. So it's going to be very individualized. One of the ways I do it is by monitoring their symptoms a little bit closely. Rather than saying, come back in a week, we'll see how you're doing, I try to keep track of their symptoms. I have emails with parents. People in my office will follow up with a parent one or two days after I see them just to see how they're doing. And that's sometimes we pick up a couple of the changes there, monitoring the symptoms, and then working with the athletic trainers who will see the kids on a daily basis a lot of times. So I will use the athletic trainers to help me kind of individualize the protocols that I need to use for the treatment.
If there's time, I'd like for him to touch on the study that you are doing with GE and the MRI. I think the Deidre Duke, the athletic trainer, that extraordinaire that is helping you in the office, and explain the criteria. So if anybody's interested in having an athlete who has a concussion into that study, would be awesome.
Right. So this is part of the NFL Head Start research program. And it's a study done by GE, funded by the NFL. And there's a multi-site, San Francisco, New York City, and Houston are the three sites for this study. And GE's developed some technology to potentially use the MRI signal and look at it a little bit differently to find a biomarker for acute concussions. So they are doing that. We're looking at individuals with a relatively acute concussion. So it's got to be within 8 days in order to be entered into the study. So we do have to scan them within 8 days of that. And then there's some other criteria in terms of prior concussions. Can't have had one in the past 6 months. Certain medications. If you have metal in your body, you may not be able to do a brain MRI. So there's a few other criteria. If you're interested, you can always call our general number, which is 713-441-8277, and we can get you hooked up with Deidre to do part of the research if you're at all interested. But again, it's for individuals with a recent new concussion.
Something else that that you brought up when we were first starting talking there, Doc, was the inflammation, concussion and inflammation. And I know there are some things that you and I have talked about, diet and stuff like that, that we've chatted about briefly. But what are you finding with that inflammation?
What we're finding right now is what we're discovering is what we think is going on with concussions, with the acute effects of concussions, or what we call these subconcussive hits, is that it's turning out to be an inflammatory response in the brain. So just like things that swell up, if you injure a muscle or a joint, that causes inflammation. And we are seeing that that's probably what's happening in the brain a little bit. And there are markers or chemical markers or physical markers of inflammation in the brain, which we're starting to discover. If brain cells and fibers stay inflamed, just like anything that's prolonged inflamed, it doesn't necessarily recover 100%. Now, why one individual is more prone to brain inflammation than another, that's a very good question. And it's likely a genetic phenomenon. We just don't know exactly the exact location or the exact different genes involved, but we do know there are plenty of genes that do promote brain growth, that do promote cleaning out of trash in the brain, so byproducts of the brain, and there are genetic markers that that are associated with developing dementia, severe TBI, multiple sclerosis, a bunch of other brain diseases. So one of our targets in research right now is to detect when that inflammatory response starts in the brain. And obviously, secondary is what can we do to help calm that down? And there are a couple of studies going on. I know there's a couple of universities in the area that are using omega-3, pharmaceutical-grade omega-3 prophylactically, so pre-season and throughout the season, to help prevent inflammation from developing in the brain.
And now, is that the markers that you're looking for with these new MRI techniques as well? And as well as, I know, kind of somewhat with the blood work and stuff like that, but kind of explain or expand upon that if you can a little bit.
Okay. So with some of the brain MRI stuff, yes, they're looking for that. So one of the effects of inflammation on the brain is what we call tau. TAU is a protein in the brain, and when it's inflamed or when it's damaged, the tau hyperphosphorylates, so it kind of breaks down, I guess, is a good way of looking at it. And you can use certain biomarkers or ligands, what we call them, to tag on to the tau. So it's like what we call a contrast dye, and it's specific to that tau. So with an MRI, you can light that up and show where the tau is being deposited in the brain. In terms of blood work, there are some biomarkers that aren't necessarily looking at tau because you have to go into the spinal fluid. But if you just draw blood from there, there are certain other chemicals that are the byproducts of that inflammatory response. And that's what they're looking at in some of the blood draws that they're doing.
You know, currently we do a baseline test, you know, looking at the cognitive part. Do you think we're ever going to get to the point where we can actually look at the physiological and see if a person is more prone to an inflammation so that we can predict if they sustain a head injury, they're going to be more prone to concussion?
So, yes, and the answer to that is probably yes, but I doubt we're anywhere near that. If they can figure out the genetics of the neuroinflammatory response to a point that it could be used clinically, then that would be great. I'll give you an example with Alzheimer's. There are genetic markers of Alzheimer's. And if you have a certain genetic pattern, it increases your risk of Alzheimer's by 3 or 4 fold. Okay. But nothing guarantees that it will happen. So you could have a 4-time risk of developing Alzheimer's, but still never develop it. So people with this genetic pattern have a higher rate of Alzheimer's, 4 times greater than someone that doesn't have that particular pattern. So we can say the same thing about genetics of tau and inflammation, that, yeah, we can say that it's a higher risk. And I guess we can use that genetic information to guide us whether my kid's going to play football or he's going to play a contact sport or not play a contact sport.
All right, I have a question. We're looking at a girl that had a concussion in soccer last year and then another one this year. What are your criteria for beginning to think, hey, you can't go back to playing this sport for the rest of high school?
Can you repeat that question for me, please? I'm sorry.
All right. We have a kid that she had a concussion last year. She had another one this year. What are your criteria for looking at not returning to playing that sport, not returning to soccer?
Right. So retiring an athlete or allowing them to return to play is always a tricky thing. And it used to be that, you know, there was this magic number of 3 concussions and you're done. And it turns out that that works sometimes, but not necessarily something that guides the decision-making process. And there are a couple of factors that play into it. Number one is, how many concussions have they had over a certain period of time? So let's say 4 concussions over 20 years is not the same thing as 4 concussions in 18 months, right? So that kind of enters into it. How long it took to recover from all the concussions is an important thing. If each time they get a concussion, they're better in 48 hours, 72 hours, that's one thing. If it takes 2 weeks, the last concussion took 8 weeks to get over, that's a little bit different issue, and we're going to kind of counsel them on some of that. If they never fully recover, i.e. cognitively, they still have problems balance-wise, vision-wise, neck-wise, if we can't get them over it, then we're not going to ever return them to play if they're still symptomatic. But on these asymptomatic cases, counseling them about whether they can return to play is going to depend a lot on these factors. The other thing is what is their long-term prospect for continuing to play that sport? So here's a very good example. This past football season, I saw a junior high school football player who was 6'3 and 260 pounds. All right, he's a big boy, offensive lineman, and he's being scouted. And comes from a rural part of Texas, and probably about the only way he'll go to college is through scholarship. It was about his 3rd concussion that I can tell in high school football, and he got over this one in about 7 days, so pretty much where we would expect it. And it becomes a very delicate conversation with the patient and the parents about returning to play. You know, maybe you sit out the rest of this season and focus on your senior year, and we'll see what happens, because we know how important the sport is to your long-term thing. If I have a private school kid that loves to play football but really isn't built for football, and they've had multiple concussions, maybe we are a little bit more concerned about returning to the sport because it doesn't hold anything down the road for that individual, and we just might be better off transitioning to a different sport.
All right. It's...
I mean, my question there is how do we assist in that assessment, or assist in that as an athletic trainer? Because obviously we're going to have those issues and those student athletes and that. And what can we do to help guide that decision, or help you as the doctor? All right, this might be the best thing for you. Or, you know what, this might not.
Right. I think it can go a couple of different ways. But me professionally, one of the ways I envision it is that the athletic trainer is often the closest to that player versus the head coach versus the team doctor versus the concussion person. And I need that. I need the athletic trainer leveraging that relationship with that player and to really kind of almost coach them or counsel them about how they're feeling and about being helping them to stay objective. When we have these high-level competitive athletes, they've put a lot of time, a lot of effort, and they've given up a lot to be where they're at. And they don't want to give that up because it's pride, it's determination, it's who they are, and it's what they've put into where they are right now. And it becomes very difficult to be completely objective about that. I'm not saying everyone is like that, but you can see how that happens. All they've been taught is to be competitive, get back in the game, and you know, keep trying. And sometimes it's the athletic trainer, I like them to help me by talking to the patient and getting into their head a little bit and knowing where they're coming from and helping them to try to be a little objective. Hey, you know what? You've had this injury four times. You still haven't fully recovered. It's 3 weeks later. We got to talk about this. What's the long-term implications for you?
All right. One final question here. Have you ever had a concussion?
Yes.
Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Which one?
Well, okay. Well, there you go. That's part of your story.
I've had three sports-related concussions. I must have been sixth or seventh grade. I don't remember which one. Outdoor recess, running on an asphalt basketball court, and had someone trip me, took my legs out from under me, and just went straight down onto the asphalt. And I don't think I was knocked out on that one, but definitely was not feeling so good for a few days after that. The next one was freshman year in high school. And again, it was basketball. I was on a breakaway. Unfortunately, I was not faster than the kid that was chasing me, and he took me out, and I went backwards on that one and hit the back of my head on the court as I was going up for the jump. That one, I was out for a little while, and that was not a good concussion. So I definitely remember, I have this vague, surreal feeling of sitting on the end of the bench, kind of everything being really far away, like a tunnel in. Definitely took me a good couple of weeks to get over that. And the very third one, I think, was a junior, where there was a little time I dabbled in gymnastics, and I was on the rings. I was doing my dismount, and I missed my dismount, and I missed the mat by just an inch. And hit my head on the court on that one. So I've had three. But that's not the passion. That's not why I got into this. One of the main reasons I got into the concussion stuff was a female soccer player that I saw back in the early 90s who came to me for some lingering problems. And I didn't know what to do. Couldn't get her better, and we had a lot of difficulties, and just realized how little we knew about these injuries and how little doctors cared about the injury back then. And it just really started my passion for kind of focusing on that. And it was a pretty much an uphill battle back then, nobody wanted to listen about concussions back in the late 80s and in the early 90s. So yeah, I've had a few and stopped my professional trajectory for being a professional athlete.
I think that's really, really huge to be able to say that too, Doc, because I mean, obviously I know how that feels as well. And being able to compare your traumatic experience or those experiences with your athletes are always really big, really a lot of help. They definitely make them understand, and you can sit down and say, these are the symptoms that I maybe still have as a practicing athletic trainer, as whatever, or as a doctor, as all these different things. And you can kind of say, hey, I'm looking out for your best interests. I'm looking out for what's going to be best for you. So
I think in medicine overall is the human side, the bedside manner part, is if you can share your experience, mm-hmm. you know, within reason, you know, because we are all athletes and we thank you for sharing your story as well. And thank you for your expertise and your availability to help all of us out here in the rank and file. Dr. Padel, it's a great comfort to know that you're a phone call or email away when we need a question answered. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. And I appreciate you guys being in the trenches for me.
Dr. Padel, if somebody wants to reach out to you, get a hold of you, find out more, maybe more about one of the studies we talked about here, what's the best way to do that?
There's two ways. You can email me. It's always a good way. kpodel@houstonmethodist.org. Or you can always call 713-441-8277.
All right. So if you want to get a hold of Dr. Kenneth Padel, you can email him or give him a phone call. Find out more about any of the studies, the information, or maybe just hear some more stories about his days in gymnastics. So
they're short-lived. Okay.
All right. Well, Dr. Padel, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
All right. So it is National Athletic Training Month right now. If you're listening to this as soon as it's released, there are lots of prizes on the sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/NATM for National Athletic Training Month. So sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/NATM. There's 8 or 9 different prizes up there right now. So check those out. Some of them are more specific if you're in Houston, because there's going to be some registrations to CEU workshops. So check those out. Register there. You can sign up for one or all of them. So check it out. sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/NATM to register to win some of those prizes from Houston Methodist or from Frio Hydration, from Memorial Hermann, from Erosti. So lots of different places are wanting to add value to you as an athletic trainer. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/NATM. So for Jeremy Jackson, Sports Medicine Broadcast, Miss Kathy Shupa, Sean Reedy, and Dr. Kenneth Padel, that is a wrap.